I think the people who are running this trust, who are controlling the entire process, were none of them victims of these fires. Don't understand the need for speed.
Teresa McDonald, who lost her home nearly 3 years ago in the fire that burned down the town of Paradise in Northern California. It was the most destructive and deadliest fire in state history. More than 80 people died. That fire was sparked by faulty equipment owned by utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric. As part of a bankruptcy settlement, PG&E agreed to pay out more than $13 billion to victims of that fire, the Camp Fire, and several other recent fires in Northern California. The money was put in a special fire victims trust. But a new report from KQED reveals that nearly all the victims, Teresa McDonald included, have not seen a dime of that money. Meanwhile, the trust has paid out about $50 million in fees. Joining us with details on her findings is Lily Jamali. She's co-host of KQED's The California Report. Hi, Lily.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, this settlement allocated $13.5 billion for the victims of three fires in Northern California. How was this trust formed?
Yeah, well, this trust was formed last year as a part of PG&E's most recent bankruptcy. You might remember they were in bankruptcy 2 decades ago. They went into bankruptcy again in 2019 because of having caused several fires in the years 2015, 2017, and 2018. And so folks lost, their homes. We're talking about thousands and thousands of homes, businesses, and in some cases, of course, people lost loved ones as well. So this trust was really set up to help facilitate the distribution of those billions of dollars. And what we found, as you laid out, was that in the first year of this trust's existence, it doled out a whole lot more money to pay itself, to pay administrators, to pay law firms and Wall Street firms, whereas a fraction of that went to actual fire victims.
And why is that? Why weren't the victims paid first?
Well, we would have loved to have talked to the trustee about that. They declined numerous requests for information to get the answer to that very question. What I can tell you is that, these processes do take time. The judge last year, the bankruptcy judge, Dennis McCauley, up here in San Francisco, when he greenlit the trust in April, 3 months before PG&E left bankruptcy, he himself questioned why some of these fees were so high. And he was asking the people, the proponents, to basically let the trust move forward with its work 3 months before the bankruptcy even ended. He said, is this going to be worth it? Is it worth these millions of dollars that are probably going to get spent on overhead? He was assured that this was absolutely necessary because, if they got it set up and ready to go, once the bankruptcy was over and people started submitting their questionnaires and all of their documents, that this money would move out the door a lot more quickly than it has.
Right. So you report that the administrator, the trustee of this, a man named John Trotter, charges $1,500 an hour.
Yeah, so what we can see from this most recent filing, this annual report, is that he made $150,000 per month. The top claims administrator is making $1,250 an hour. And make no mistake, fire victims are seeing all of this. These are folks that are on Facebook. They are, very connected with each other, and they are monitoring all of these filings. And they, basically called this out last year, and they've been trying to voice their concerns from the very beginning. And unfortunately, the way our bankruptcy system works, from what they will say, they feel that their voices were really crowded out by this cadre of lawyers and others that really ran the process.
And give us a sense of how they're coping. Their homes, well, they were destroyed up in Paradise. What's life like for them now?
What's so fascinating is that this set of fires that PG&E caused affects so many communities up here in Northern California. For from Paradise and surrounding communities like Magalia and Concow in 2018 over to Sonoma County, you know, some of the most expensive real estate in California, in wine country. Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing is that a lot of these people are having very different experiences. What I've noticed is the earlier fires people had, in some cases, an easier time with their insurance companies. They are, you know, somewhat a little more better positioned to move on. In Paradise, the situation's been really different. They were the last of the set of fires that was involved here. And so many of those folks, many of them were retired. They were hoping that the houses that they lived in would be their get old homes, as some of them call them, the places they were planning to retire and live comfortably for the rest of their lives. I spoke with a guy named Bill Cook, really sweet man who is 70 years old, was living in Paradise in a 6-bedroom house, 3,000 square feet. And he is now living with 9 of his family members in a house in Davis, where he is having to eat into his savings to rent. He's paying 3 times what he paid on his mortgage in Paradise. And honestly, I think he probably considers himself among the lucky people, because if you go to Paradise and some of those other communities, there are so many people that are still living in trailers that are really stuck in limbo and desperately need this money now.
Is it a question of time, like they'll eventually get their money, or will all of these administrators and lawyers eat up the fund and they won't get the money that they're entitled to?
Well, I think, you know, given the size of the fund itself, you know, it's hard to imagine a scenario where administrative costs end up eating into this more than, say, 3-4%. But we're talking about such a huge amount of money. This fund is on paper worth $13.5 billion. What has really complicated this whole process is the way this trust was conceived of from the start. What they did was PG&E decided to set it up with half cash and half stock in PG&E itself. And this was really disturbing to so many fire survivors that we talked to last year, who were looking at sort of the emotional element to that, of being compensated through this trust with stock in the company that harmed them. I mean, think about how difficult that must be. And mm-hmm. in a very practical way, what that's done is it's really tethered their compensation to how PG&E performs year after year. And PG&E obviously has quite a bit of risk exposure compared to other companies, because year after year, they are causing fires. They have a lot of work to do on their lines, on their equipment, to make sure it doesn't cause more fires. They will tell you that they are doing everything they can to make their system better. But we've also seen regulators call them out for not getting that work done as quickly as it needs to happen. So what this means for fire victims is that for now, for the very lucky few, and we're talking about 350 odd people out of 70,000 fire victims who have actually had their claims fully processed right as of right now and paid out, they're only getting 30% of what they are actually owed, of what the trust has determined that they are owed, because the pot of money with that stock component included fluctuates every single day. So if PG&E stock is up or down a dollar on a given day, that pot of money is worth $500 million more or less.
Wow, just so complicated and so tragic for the victims, compounding misery on top of their loss. Lily Jamali, co-host of KQED's California Report, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
And you can read more about that at KQED's website. The Salton Sea. It has been called the biggest environmental disaster in California history, inhospitable to wildlife with toxic dust, sometimes blowing all the way to L.A. But the Salton Sea could be a valuable source of lithium. That's a key ingredient in batteries for electric cars, cell phones, other forms of renewable energy. There is a lithium gold rush going on right now in America as we transition to electric cars. But most of the lithium mines are catastrophic for the environment. And that includes a massive site next door in Nevada that's about to go online. Ivan Penn joins me now. He's co-written a big article on this for the New York Times, where he covers alternative energy. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, what is happening? Why this so-called lithium gold rush?
Well, with the emphasis now on transitioning from fossil fuels to renewable energy, batteries storage has been viewed really as the holy grail in energy. And especially when we're starting to talk about transitioning from gasoline-fueled vehicles to electrified vehicles. So now the question is, where do we get the resources to support that? And lithium-ion batteries is the technology right now for EVs, but most of that material comes from either South America or Australia. And now the emphasis is, well, if we're going to do these things in the United States, then we should tap the resources that exist here.
And are there a lot of resources here? Is there a lot of lithium in the United States?
We have an enormous amount of lithium in deposits from California to the south and east. Enough lithium really to meet all of our domestic needs in terms of electric vehicles, as well as some of the other areas that we use it in, like batteries for energy home storage.
Mm. All right. Well, let's talk about what's happening first in Nevada. This is a project called Lithium Americas. It's a huge traditional mining operation that was approved in the final days of the Trump administration. First of all, describe what this mine looks like and how it would mine lithium.
Well, so as you mentioned, this is more traditional mining operation where you see the blasting and the digging, a giant pit. And of course, the concerns with that are all of the traditional concerns. One person sort of said, blowing up a mountain, that's not environmental. And then there becomes the concern about the groundwater. So how does this affect the drinking water as well as the geography?
Yeah, where do they get the water from, especially in Nevada?
Well, so a lot of this is groundwater that not only exists for drinking or agriculture, but this would also serve to assist in these mining projects.
Right. I think the statistic in your story, which is pretty eye-popping, is it takes 3,200 gallons of water per minute to mine lithium at this one site in Nevada, which is amazing.
Yeah, with that particular technology, and that's why there is this huge frenzy that you mentioned, with different ways of approaching it so that you don't have to cause that kind of disruption.
And one of them is in the Salton Sea. And so describe that process, which is being described as much more environmentally acceptable.
Sure. So you mentioned in the beginning the natural disaster that the Salton Sea has become. What has resulted from the retreating waters there is more unveiling of the geothermal energy that is beneath the ground. So this geothermal energy is basically, they're little volcanoes. It's underground, and it's used generally around the Salton Sea to produce geothermal power. There are about a dozen geothermal plants, some mostly owned, actually, by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Energy. This is a renewable source of power that produces 24/7, unlike solar or wind. But it also, it's a salty water. They call it a brine. There are minerals in it, including lithium. And so the process they're looking to use there at the Salton Sea is to take that briny water and extract the lithium from that water and be able to supply potentially enough just around the Salton Sea area. There's a potential to supply much of the need of the United States, at least some of the estimations.
So why not pursue this instead of this really dirty mine that we just described in Nevada?
Well, so in Nevada, we actually don't have much lithium mining going on today. The Salton Sea projects are underway, and there are three in particular. They're largely in the pilot stages. I mean, they haven't even completed the pilot production stage. They're just in the beginning stages of developing their pilots. In the Nevada case, you know, you already have some infrastructure that's been developed. But in terms of how much lithium is produced in the country, you know, we're talking 2% or less than what is developed around the world. But it's existing. And that becomes, you know, I mean, that's always a factor. You know, what do we have in place versus what is under development?
And where is the Biden administration on this?
Well, so right now, the administration has supported just across the board the development of domestic lithium. Now, they have heavily pointed to the efforts at the Salton Sea. And, you know, California has, as a state, pushed hard in its own marketing. They've labeled the Salton Sea area, quote, Lithium Valley, playing off of Silicon Valley. So really putting a stake in the ground to say, hey, you know, we've got a significant and at least more environmentally friendly source of lithium here in California. And in addition to that, in an area that has been economically depressed, high unemployment, and this has the potential to bring a lot of good jobs, which has really excited the administration. But then, you know, there are other places around the country in the Midwest and North Carolina where they're also making the argument to the administration that, hey, we can develop some sustainable sources of lithium in these areas as well. And right now, the administration has not discarded any at this point.
Well, Ivan, thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
That's Ivan Penn from the New York Times, where you can read his big article on lithium mining. Don't panic, but there's a giant rocket hurtling toward Earth right now, uncontrolled. Yeah, I'll tell you more about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Don't panic, but sometime over the weekend, a Chinese rocket is expected to hit the Earth. It's moving at around 18,000 miles per hour. And here's the problem. Scientists aren't totally sure where it's going to land. And they won't know for a while until it's mere hours away from the Earth's surface. The risk to people is low, but the Pentagon and the White House are monitoring. Joining us now is Mike Wall, senior space writer for space.com. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, a little nervous because I'm afraid a rocket is going to land on my head over the weekend. How afraid should humans be that this could actually fall on land where humans live?
Yeah, you shouldn't be too scared, really. I mean, the Earth is about 70% ocean. So chances are it'll come down over the ocean because that's what the odds say. So people shouldn't panic. But yeah, I mean, it does sort of highlight like a little bit of an issue. You know, if we put stuff up there, it's not out of sight, out of mind. Like just because you launch a rocket, it doesn't mean it just disappears. You have to actually deal with what you've put up there, you know.
Well, how did this happen in the first place? So the Chinese sent this rocket up to the space station, right? And then there's this debris falling down. Why is it falling down now?
That's a good question. A lot of people are asking, why did China let this happen? You know, this is the rocket that actually launched the big core piece of the new Chinese space station that's supposed to be built by 2022. It was just about a week ago. And when you have a big rocket like that, I mean, most rocket operators will try to bring that core stage down quickly and kind of steer it over uninhabited ocean. So they know that it's going to burn up over a spot where it can't cause any damage. But like this one made it to orbit, which is not universally considered like responsible behavior. And it doesn't like appear that there's a way to steer it. And so it's just going to fall back to Earth after the atmosphere drags it down, which is what we're seeing happening now. We do know that it could hit anywhere between about 40 degrees north of the equator to 40 degrees south. So anywhere basically from like New York City's latitude down to like Sydney. like in Australia. That's a pretty big patch of the planet.
Yeah, that is a big patch of the planet. And so what is complicating the projections as to where it's going to land?
Well, it's a complicated thing to actually model. Earth's atmosphere is very dynamic. It can change density and size basically based on solar activity. If the sun has been producing a lot of like sort of flares and stuff like that, the Earth's atmosphere can puff out, and so the like drag will increase. And so it's just really hard to actually model that. And that's why we won't know until like a few hours beforehand when and where this thing is gonna come down. And if you don't know when it's gonna come down, then you don't know where, because this thing's moving super fast, right? So if you're off by an hour, then you're off by like thousands and thousands of miles about where it's gonna come down.
So how does it normally happen? What happens with the debris from other rockets?
Yeah, most of these big rockets, you know, they're sort of steered toward like a ditching in the ocean, which is not very far from the launch site. You know, that's why a lot of big rockets launch over the ocean on the coast, you know, because that's just safer. You can like ditch that big first stage into the ocean and not worry about hurting anybody except for maybe some fish or some dolphins. But this rocket reached orbital velocity. So it actually, that big first stage, whose job was just to get that space station module aloft, it didn't just come back down really quickly. It actually got up into Earth orbit. And when that happens, it just zips around Earth until atmospheric drag pulls you down. And as we were just talking about, you know, that's an uncontrolled crash. If you can't like relight the rocket engines on that first stage and steer it somewhere, it's just going to come back at the whims of the atmosphere.
But this is something that is preventable. The Chinese could have designed it not to do that.
Yeah, we don't see this happen very often. You know, that's another way to sort of say this. This is the second time in less than a year that we've seen the same Chinese rocket. You know, there was another Long March 5B rocket last May that did the same thing, like made it up into orbit, about a 20-ton big like chunk of space junk, came back down again like a week or so later. I mean, most of it burned up off like the West African coast over the Atlantic, but apparently some pieces of it did make it down onto land. So people do tend to try to take measures to keep this from happening. But this is the second time in the last 12 months we've seen this from the same Chinese rocket.
When you talk about the stuff that does make it to land, how big is that? How big is that chunk? I mean, if we're talking about a 22 metric ton rocket, how much of it actually falls to the Earth?
Yeah, probably not a lot of it. Most of it will burn up just because, you know, I mean, when it comes back into the atmosphere, there's so much frictional heating. It just is so hot. It burns up most of the rocket. But some pieces that are extremely hard, you know, made of like especially hard metals, I mean, part of the engines, they might make it to the ground. And that's sort of what we saw last May with this rocket, too. Some of it did come down. But also, you know, China is not like typically all that forthcoming about their like rocket designs and their plans. And so it's just hard to know.
If it were to fall over a population center, would there be enough warning time? Like, and how would people be warned?
Yeah, we probably will know within a couple hours, like a general patch of Earth's surface where it's going to come down. And I mean, I don't know that there's going to need to be evacuations because like by the time it starts burning up, any pieces that do make it to the ground are not going to be moving like that fast. It'll be like the equivalent of maybe something falling off of the jetliner or something. So that would still be bad to get hit by an engine falling off a jetliner, but it's not like going to cause a giant explosion or like a huge smoking crater, probably something like that. What'll probably happen is some people will go outside and look up and see pretty dramatic sky show. That's probably going to be the extent of the experience for most people who are kind of in the overflight zone.
So they shouldn't worry about it hitting them on the head?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, like you could worry about it, I guess, but the chances are just so small, you know, like that your square meter of ground that you're standing on is going to be where like a chunk of rocket engine falls. It's just, I mean, you do your own health more sort of damage worrying about it with the stress and so on than you would by being under it. It's just, it's one of those things that's not worth worrying about, but it does serve to sort of highlight the whole space junk problem.
Right. And there's thousands of pieces of space debris floating out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's only going to get worse, this problem, if we don't address it, because it's getting cheaper to launch things and it's getting cheaper to build satellites that are very capable and very small. And so there are more and more people, more and more satellite operators who are launching things. And I mean, it's not just like the global superpowers who are spacefaring anymore. You know, there's a lot of different operators now, and that means there's a lot of people of sort of varying skill levels, expertise levels, and experience. But it also just really rams home the fact that we need to have protocols in place about how we prevent these things from becoming space junk and just dead pieces of fast-moving metal that are just waiting to slam into another satellite or something up there, waiting to fall to Earth. We just need to have a conversation globally about what the best means are to avoid that happening.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens this weekend. Mike Wall, senior space writer for space.com. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, while you're waiting for some space junk to fall on your head, you might as well become a member of KCRW and end on an up note. KCRW.com/give. Join today and thank you. Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews, including a documentary about Sesame Street.
It is the history of the thing that saved children's TV from itself. And there are outtakes of Muppets swearing.
Woo! Okay, stay tuned for that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Happy Film Review Friday. Here with some movie recommendations are Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Hi, you guys. Happy spring.
Hello.
Hello.
It's kind of gloomy out there, so let's just cozy up to a movie like a warm and fuzzy one full of guns called Wrath of Man, director Guy Ritchie's latest action thriller. It stars Jason Statham as a mysterious security guard for cash trucks. And here's a bit from the trailer.
It doesn't feel right. It's like he wants trucks to get hit. He's not a cop. But if he's not a cop, what is he?
A while back, we lost two cars, a civilian too.
There was an investigation.
And they still haven't found the scum who did it.
I need to know who killed my son.
Aha, okay. So he needs to know who's the killer of his son. He's, again, another Liam Neeson pretender. What's happening here, Alonzo?
Oh, I don't know if we can call Jason Statham a Liam Neeson pretender, because the Liam Neeson formula is, you know, established important actor, you know, reaches a certain age and now suddenly is a gun-toting badass. Jason Statham's kind of always been a gun-toting badass. Like that's
yeah,
his
okay.
stock in trade. Early on, in fact, with director Guy Ritchie, who is with whom he is reuniting here for Wrath of Man. I had no idea they tell you in the trailer that he's avenging the death of his son. I was writing around that in my review because I thought it was a spoiler. But yeah, you are left to wonder, why is this man suddenly getting a job for a for an armored car company, particularly an armored car company that in the opening moments of the film, we see one of their trucks getting hijacked and the driver's killed. As it unfolds, we come to understand exactly what Statham's agenda is, and also who did that robbery at the beginning of the movie, and then how those two storylines are going to bump into each other with great violence, which they do.
Yeah, it seems very gun heavy, just looking at the trailer. Dave, what did you think?
It sure is.
You know, it's gloomier and moodier than most of Guy Ritchie's earlier work, but it is effectively, very effectively, the thing that it is.
Yes.
You know, Jason Statham is this handsome granite human that is called upon to do the one thing that he is always called upon to do, and that is stoically murder bad guys. I like it.
It's good to have a skill set.
It is.
You know, I think if you're a fan of the way that Guy Ritchie does these movies, there are like that opening robbery, for example, is told entirely in one shot from a camera that's in the back of the armored car vehicle. But by the end of the movie, you will see this robbery from about three or four different angles and come to understand how it plays into the rest of the story. There's a lot of jumping back and forth in time. So things will happen and then it's 5 months earlier. And then we find out things from the point of view of entirely different characters. And so that all comes together really interestingly.
Okay, moving on to, well, I guess this is a movie about another very violent man. This is called State Funeral, and it's a documentary about the death and funeral of Joseph Stalin. We're not going to hear any from the trailer because it's in Russian. Let's go straight to you, Dave. What did you think of this movie, and why are we seeing it now?
Well, this is from Sergei Loznitsa, who is a skilled artist when it comes to archival materials. What you're getting with State Funeral is an all-archival documentary, where he has taken, you know, 40 hours of official state footage of not just the funeral proceedings in 1953 when Stalin died, but the gatherings of people from all across Russia as they met in their towns and villages to mourn the passing of Stalin. It is a staggering visual spectacle. It's this mix of black and white footage and color footage. And sometimes those black and white and color scenes are played off each other in the same room where the same moment is being covered. There's just this enormous scale. Thousands and thousands of mourners are all gathered in Moscow in brutal cold and rain. And they're outside waiting to get in. There's this elaborate ceremony. There is a power coffin that steals the show.
What's frilly, a power coffin?
It's frilly, glamorous, this Deanna Vreeland red with a clear bubble top so his face could be seen. It's like a space pod. It's insane. But the most important thing here is this awkward humanity on display. Hmm. There's no narration, but you don't need it. All you need is what you're seeing to, you know, understand that the official pronouncements that are coming out of loudspeakers about the glory of the USSR and the beautiful happiness of all of its citizens, that's not what you're seeing when you're hearing that stuff.
So there's no narration. It's just scenes it's cut together. Yeah,
no interviews, not a minimum of chyrons even. Like there's,
interesting.
They are not holding your hand through any of this. It's just showing you how it all went down and how it was, more important, I think, how it was captured by, I'm sure, the sort of state news service at the time. And then you're hearing what the state radio and other sources were saying about the event.
Yes. So, you know, it's a stunning film. And it's unlike.
And is he making an overall point about, I don't know, about Russia, yes, about Stalin, about how we revere our
propaganda?
Authoritarian
leaders? I think certainly is mm-hmm. is one of the things they're looking at. And lest anybody think that this is some sort of like glorification, you get the title cards at the end of the movie that tell you all the Stalin facts that you need to know about, you know, the horror of the purges and whatnot.
An amazing film, highly recommended. My kind of history lesson for sure.
Where do we see it?
At the Lemley Royal. It's playing here in town right now on a big screen at the Lemley Royal.
All right. Up next, an older film, The Story of a Three-Day Pass. This is a restoration of a 1968 Melvin Van Peebles French New Wave film about a black soldier stationed in France. He gets a three-day pass from base, goes to Paris, and has a lot of fun. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Turner, I have a pleasant surprise for you.
A three-day pass.
Now remember, if I can't trust you, I'll bust you.
You are the captain's Uncle Tom, baby.
I'm not the captain's Uncle Tom. Maybe yes, maybe no.
Okay, so there he is talking to himself in the mirror. Alonzo, why is this film being restored now?
Well, you know, Melvin Van Peebles is one of the just essential figures of Black American filmmaking. A couple years after this, he made his first studio film, Watermelon Man, and then followed that up with a film that continues to have historical resonance, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which I think is still one of the most profitable independent films ever made, and certainly one that has had reverberations in the culture and in politics. It's a film that was championed by the Black Panthers at the time. So this is his very first film, and Van Peebles is one of these guys who you read his life story, and he just did everything and went everywhere. He wrote this novel in France, and then France, bless their hearts, would offer novelists a $60,000 grant to adapt their own work into films that were artistic but not necessarily commercial. So he took that $60,000, found a producer, got a $200,000 budget, and made this movie. And this is where his storied film career begins. And so, yeah, it does have a lot of new wave influences. You can see it in the editing, but it's also very much about, you know, the kind of issues that he would come back to over and over again. We heard in that clip, you know, his white commanding officer talked about being able to trust him. And what that boils down to is him behaving in a way that is palatable to the white power structure. So, of course, when he gets involved with a white French woman and other people in his, you know, platoon from his base find out about that, he gets into trouble. And so, you know, it's interesting. There was a documentary last year called Myth of a Colorblind France that basically mm-hmm. took the idea that, you know, James Baldwin and all of these, you know, black artists and intellectuals sort of fled to France as this place where they wouldn't have to face, you know, the same kind of racism they would in the United States. And yeah, France has its own brand of that. Ask mm-hmm. any Algerian, you know. And so you see that at play in this film, as well as within the military structure, you know, sort of American racism making itself known in other countries.
Oh, interesting. Dave, what did you think of this movie?
This is the most exciting 50 plus year old movie released this week. And it includes narrative points that people are still grappling with today. This is a really an amazing film. It's an important film from the time, and it's still relevant.
The Story of a 3-Day Pass. And where can we see this one?
That is screening at the Lemley NoHo.
Okay. Finally, we have a film out that came out last week, but we're going to review it today. Yeah. It's a documentary about the beloved Sesame Street. It's called Street Gang, and here's a bit from the trailer.
Children were watching a tremendous amount of television.
So why not see if it could educate them?
I was convinced that it would be impossible to do.
I saw it as a political show.
There's no question that we're integrated. That's our worst sin. I'm happy to be a sinner.
Beautiful children will grow up.
And make the whole world beautiful.
Right on.
Well, this kind of fits with the previous film we were just discussing. And Dave, this is, just looking at the trailer, I started to cry. I mean, this seems like just a lovely walk down memory lane.
Very much like the Mr. Rogers documentary that came out a couple of years ago. This does push nostalgia buttons for people who, you know, grew up with that. I was 5 years old when Sesame Street first aired. And so watching this film and learning the history of this show, it was, you know, one thing. But the other thing was singing along with these little cartoons that they would play about how to count to 12 and thinking, how is it that I still remember this, you know, 50 years later? But Sesame Street was revolutionary because at the time, children's TV was this proto version of what it is now, a way to sell toys and candy. There's a little clip in the film from an earlier kids show where they're selling candy in the show, like, tell your mom you want Tootsie Roll, you know. So Joan Ganz Cooney and Lloyd Morissette Jr. founded the Children's Television Workshop, and they developed Sesame Street as a way to give children in marginalized communities a chance to succeed in school and to do it with the same techniques that advertisers used to make you remember the Budweiser commercial. And it worked. They had all the right people at the right moment. Jim Henson's Muppets, songwriter Joe Raposo, and a fiercely devoted director, a man named John Stone, who you did not mess with. Mm-hmm. And this documentary is so lovely. It's got archival footage. It's got background you don't know about, you know, behind the scenes stuff of what, you know, had to happen on the parts of the creators. It is the history of the thing that saved children's TV from itself. And there are outtakes of Muppets swearing.
Okay, sold. Alonzo?
Yeah, I mean, look, Sesame Street taught me how to read, and I barely remember life without it because I was two when it debuted. And so what's fascinating is to look back now and understand what a huge deal it was when it happened. Like, I think it has become this established icon of television that we just take for granted and assume, oh, it was always there. There's always been Sesame Street. But no, somebody had to create Sesame Street, and somebody had to create it in a surroundings by which nobody was looking for that show, and nobody necessarily wanted to immediately support that show because it was so daring, not just in terms of being educational and being, you know, progressive, but, you know, talking about race and talking about, you know, gender issues and all the kind of stuff that that show addressed, that taught kids to believe in themselves and that they were capable of doing whatever they wanted to. It is it's a beautiful film, and it's, I think everybody's going to come away with something they didn't know about Sesame Street. And that film premieres today on streaming. It was out in theaters a week ago, but now everybody can watch it from home.
You guys, thank you. Yes. Thanks for ending on an up note. Alonzo Duralde, Dave White, film critics for The Wrap, and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Coming up, what to cook for your mom on Mother's Day. Evan Kleinman is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch? Creamy,
salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, Mother's Day is Sunday, and maybe you didn't buy a gift yet. Well, do not worry, because Evan Kleinman is here. She's here with a recipe you can cook your mom as a present. Evan hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
I would love to get a meal as a present.
Who wouldn't want a meal at this point as a present? Something you don't have to think about. You just sit down, you eat it, and you say thank you.
I know. And you say thank you, and you say thank you, I didn't have to make it myself.
Absolutely.
So, hallelujah. What do you have for us?
So I have a salmon salad that is a dish that the chef of Angeli, who worked for me for many, many years, Kathy Ternay, who's a dear friend, developed for our catering business. And, you know, we always used to joke that salmon is the pretty fish because it's pink and everybody always wanted it for special occasions. And so she figured out a way to make this gorgeous salmon salad that's different from the usual and is actually pretty easy to make at home.
So when I envision salmon salad, I envision a bunch of greens with some salmon on top. This is not that.
No, this is not that. This is, you take a salmon fillet and you can take, you basically figure 8 ounces per person and you get it in one piece and you roast it over high heat, which just takes a few minutes. And I tell you how to do it in the recipe. And then when it's cool enough to touch, you very carefully with your hands lift it off the skin. And as you're putting it in the bowl, it kind of falls apart into large pieces. And then you add some thinly sliced red onion, a little bit of shaved fennel, and a really delicious dill mustard aioli. You very carefully sort of toss it together, and there you have it. It's gorgeous.
That sounds delicious. Do you garnish it with anything?
Well, one year, for some reason, I became obsessed with beet pickled eggs because the color fuchsia of the eggs was just so extraordinary. And so I realized that they would make a really beautiful garnish to this salmon. You don't have to make it if it makes your Mother's Day too complicated, or you can if you take the time or somebody else in your house helps you do it. The most important thing of this whole enterprise is not to overcook the fish and to source it well from one of our wonderful high-quality fishmongers here in town.
And what are some of those?
Well, my three favorites are going from east to west. Fish King in Glendale, just like the wonderland of fish. McCall's in Las Feliz, which is incredible. And Santa Monica Seafood.
So no Trader Joe's salmon for this occasion, is what you're saying.
No. I mean, this week, unfortunately, the wild salmon season seems to be in a transition. I talked to a few of the fishmongers, and they said they may get wild salmon in. If you can find it, use it. You may have to use a little bit more aioli because it is a bit leaner than farmed salmon. But not all farmed salmon is equal, either in the ecological impact the farms have or in the quality of the fish itself. And each of these fishmongers have very high quality farm salmon that you can feel okay eating.
And are we talking like a whole side of a salmon, one of those big things, or can we use those little fillets?
Well, what would be perfect is if the fishmonger cuts however much you need off from that big side. So you don't want a steak. You want the fillet. It doesn't have to be skinless, or it can be skinless. I like roasting it on the skin. I think it gives it a bit more flavor and it protects it a bit from getting too dry. But the way you make it is the same, whether you've bought 1 pound or 5 pounds. It's going to take you the same amount of time because fish cooks in relationship to its thickest part.
How do you know when you've cooked it to the perfect temperature?
Well, the best way is to have the perfect thermometer. This is why instant read digital thermometers are so useful. You know, somebody like myself, I can tell just by touching it if it's in the right place. It should feel firmed up, but not hard. Hard means you've overcooked it. If the albumin, the white stuff, comes out of the fish, it's overcooked. Some people use that as a mark of doneness. If you see that albumin, you have gone too far. So I would say cook it.
Once you've gone too far, is that it? Like, finished?
Just throw
it to the cat?
No, add more aioli.
Okay. Just cover it up. Cover up
lubrication. Lubrication.
Well, oftentimes I undercook it and then I cut it open and it's kind of raw in the middle.
Well, the beautiful thing about making this dish is that you don't care if it's all in one piece. So if you need to do that because you don't have a thermometer taking you to about between 125 and 135 degrees, then please cut it in half and take a look. It shouldn't be opaque all the way through. There should be a little bit of translucence in the middle.
And it does keep cooking once you take it out of the oven, right?
When absolutely. It can go up as much as 5 degrees while it's resting, especially if you've cooked it at a higher temperature, which I do. It sort of is on this upward curve. So as you take it out, it keeps cooking. But in the recipe, I give you a choice of doing it low and slow or high and fast. I'm an impatient person, so I go go for the high and fast.
Gotcha. All right. So the aioli, to cover up your mistake or to just enjoy, how do you make it?
So I like the method where you use an immersion blender and you put the eggs and the oil and the garlic in the immersion blender jar, or if you don't have that, a mason jar. And then you put the head of the immersion blender in the bottom so it's touching the bottom of the vessel. And then you turn it on and you slowly lift it up. And by the time it comes to the top of the ingredients, it's perfectly blended. There are many, many YouTube videos to show you how to do this that will make you feel much more confident. But if you don't want to bother, just get mayonnaise and doctor it by adding garlic that you've put through a garlic press, the Dijon mustard that I call for, and a copious amount of fresh dill.
Delicious. And then you just slather that on.
You just slather that on. And oh, it's so good. Especially if you have everything made in advance. So you've made your aioli. You just take the fish from the oven. As soon as you can touch it, flake it up, throw the ingredients together and eat it. When it's just a little bit still warm, it's delicious. However, if you want to make it the day before, do that. And if you want to serve it on a sandwich, do that. It's really delicious.
The egg. I was avoiding asking you about this because it seems very intimidating. But how do you make that
fuchsia
easy. Egg?
Okay, so first you hard-boil your eggs. Then you throw them in a mason jar. Well, don't throw. Gently put them in a mason jar. Separately, you're going to follow the instructions of putting the sliced beets in a vinegar solution with a little bit of water and some spices. You bring that to a boil. You let it cool so it's the same temperature as the eggs, and you pour it over. And in 24 hours, it is just the most beautiful color. If you want them to taste really pickled, then leave them in there. I one year made a mistake by making way too many, and I just enjoyed those. They were the gift that kept on giving, I must say.
Gorgeous. And then your fingers are a little bit pink, but who cares? I'm not going to be able to eat a tuna salad after this. It's just going to be so ordinary.
Exactly.
Well, thanks, Evan, and happy Mother's Day.
Thank you, Madeline.
Evan Kleiman, she is host of KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear Saturday mornings at 11 right here on KCRW. And check out the recipe. It's up on our website, kcrw.com. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Nihar Patel, Angie Perrin, and Bennett Purser. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer and all of our brains. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. And this is the end of the first week. Work week of our fundraiser. And so now is the perfect time for you to end the week on an up note by becoming a member at kcrw.com. kcrw.com. Renew your membership, become a member, do the right thing. This is our spring membership drive and our drive to the future, where we are looking forward to a better future with you. kcrw.com. Thanks. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you Monday.